Why, Brink, hello.
Hi, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine.
How are you? Welcome to your first Blogging Heads.
Well, it's very exciting. Thanks for ushering me into this brave new world.
No problem, although I'm a little upset having read the papers today and discovering that, you know, potentially naps are good for you at right about now. I think I might have to lobby Blogging Heads for some sort of, you know, napping subsidy or something. I'm a little concerned about the health effects of this.
Absolutely, particularly given the horrible, stressful situation I'm in right now in the middle of a D.C. winter storm panic.
The D.C. winter storm panic is it's a time-honored ritual. The year that I spent there, I remember that. You know, you'd have so many times, be big storm coming, big storm coming, big storm coming. You'd get maybe a half inch of snow, which, of course, would cause actual people who hadn't grown up in the Northeast to panic.
It's total, unadulterated, unabated, imbecilic hysteria. And the grocery stores are filled with people getting their bottled water and their duct tape and their Cipro, so it's an exciting time, but a stressful time, so we could use a nap maybe after we're done.
That's true, and you know, that's so unusual from normal D.C. culture, too, the panicking and all that. So,
yeah, that's right.
That's very good. All right, why don't we start with our... you wrote an essay a couple months ago about... in the wake of the 2006 midterms, about which got quickly dubbed libertarians, the idea that that economic libertarians could fuse with social libertarians within the Democratic Party, whereas historically you had sort of Frank Myers fusionism that had paired economic libertarians with social conservatives. And Brink, I have one question to ask you. Where is your libertarian god now?
Well, he's in hiding, just as the libertarian god was in hiding beforehand. I wrote this piece in recognition of the deep problems with the traditional conservative fusionist alliance between traditionalists and or social conservatives and libertarians. That has always been a philosophically dicey mixture, but it worked politically for a long time, and it's worked off and on over the years. It may work again in the future, but it hasn't been working very well of late. And with the Bush administration and the Republican Congress's conversion to big government conservatism, given very deep-seated libertarian dissatisfaction with what the right is doing, it seems at least prudent to check out and see what the other half of the political spectrum is doing. There is, libertarians have always considered themselves neither of the left nor the right. They find themselves in company with the right on economics issues and in company with the left on social and personal liberty and civil liberties issues. But as a matter of practical politics, libertarian-minded voters have tended to side with the conservatives and with the Republicans because their concern with economics issues, tax spending, regulation issues, trumped their worries about what the right would do on the social front. But with the right's abandonment of any kind of commitment to small government conservatism,
whatsoever,
runaway spending, expansion of the entitlement state, federal takeover of education policy, plus a whole raft of horrors on the civil liberties and executive power side, then suddenly the Democrats don't look so bad. And we have common ground, libertarian folks have common ground with Democrats on immigration, on the sort of joint opposition to the anti-gay marriage hysteria and the federal marriage amendment, concern about the Patriot Act and executive power overreaching in the post 9/11 world. So there's a bunch of currently existing common ground. What I tried to explore in this article was whether the real and deep differences between liberals and libertarians on economics issues might be compromised, whether there's something in the middle between the libertarian concern for controlling the size of government and protecting free markets and free exchange and the liberal concern for the liberal concern for egalitarian reforms. If there's any way to come up with a win-win batch of policies that both of us could live with, both of us would consider superior to the status quo.
I mean, you know, I blogged about this when you first wrote it. This caused quite a ripple. I mean, I had a couple thoughts at the time. The first was that it wasn't clear to me. You know, although I know Cato, for example, argues that there was the libertarian vote numbers 12%, 13% of voters from the 2006 election or from previous elections.
Something like that.
Yeah. You know, which makes them potentially an influential bloc, except it's not clear how cohesive that bloc is. And obviously, the problem I had with it, you know, the problem I had with the empirical analysis was that, you know, 2006 was an election where economic populists won the day. By and large on the Democratic side and to a lesser extent on the Republican side. So it's not clear to me that you can actually have, you know, anything more than just a tactical marriage of convenience. And even then, I'm not sure it's a tactical marriage. I mean, part of the reason it struck me that fusionism worked on the Republican side, particularly during the Reagan years, is because Reagan was willing, you know, because at that point the social conservatives were perfectly happy if Reagan just talked the talk. He didn't have to do anything more than
right.
that, necessarily. You know, there was obviously business on court appointments. There were a few other sort of feints in that direction. But let's face it, on the whole, you know, the Reagan administration was not terribly, you know, there was the Mexico City policy. But you know, beyond a few sort of symbolic markers, there wasn't a huge increase in social conservatism. And social conservatives are no longer satisfied with just that sort of situation. My fear is that if libertarians were to fuse, you know, or try to move for the libertarian instinct, you know, particularly because they'd be the newcomers to the Democratic Party, at least the economic ones, wouldn't we just sort of see a replay where the Democrats would just sort of make, you know, the occasional feint towards economic libertarianism, but in point of fact just act in a populist manner?
That's entirely possible. It, of course, depends on what the Republicans do as well. If you're a swing constituency, as libertarians hope to become, you can only swing if the other two sides are courting you or actively repelling you, one or the other. Going back to what you said about the libertarian bloc of voters, I agree wholeheartedly that it is not a cohesive or well-defined bloc. It's a completely incoherent and vague and ill-defined and unself-conscious bloc. Our ideological categories are...
And we're terribly hard to organize, let's face it, you know? I mean, it's almost, you know, part of our nature. You know, organizing libertarians is like herding cats.
No, that's right, but it's beyond that. It's our linear political left-right spectrum has room for liberals and conservatives. Those are the ideological categories. Those are how people define themselves. Libertarian isn't a category that is widely understood or used in modern political discourse, and so right now, what we're talking about are people who classify themselves as conservatives or classify themselves as liberals or classify themselves as independents and moderates, but who, in response to pollsters, show attitudes that are economically conservative and socially liberal to some degree of rigor. But they haven't been whipped into any kind of cohesive electoral bloc because our politics doesn't pay attention to them. And so that really is at the root of what I was trying to say in this New Republic article. That article contained first a diagnosis and second a prescription. The Libertarian Alliance was the prescription, and I think that's a speculative one, and whether it pans out or not, who knows. The diagnosis I'm much more comfortable about and much more confident in, and that is that our current politics, our current ideologies of left and right, have become dysfunctional. That is, that the core of the ideology of the left and the core of the ideology of the right have now become fundamentally reactionary, which is, that is, they're spending, their main energy is expended on crying over spilt milk. The right can't get over the fact that the 60s happened and brought in its wake a whole bunch of irrevocable cultural changes. The left can't get over the fact that the 80s happened and brought in its wake a whole host of irrevocable economic changes. And so, as I said in the article, you have this strange spectacle of both the left and the right pining for the 1950s. The The left wants to work there. The right wants to go home there. But there aren't any time machines. We can't go back. We have had a great deal of cultural change as a result of the convulsions of the 60s and 70s. Much of it good, some of it horrible. We've had a great deal of economic change as a result of the economic restructuring of the 70s and 80s. A lot of it good, some of it horrible. But we're not going back. And our politics is currently organized around discontents with the way things are, with the way American society has developed and where it's headed. I would argue that over the past generation, American society has become significantly more libertarian. On the cultural side, it's become much more socially liberal. And on the economic side, the economy has become much more competitive, more entrepreneurial, more globalized, more libertarian friendly. And yet our ideological categories are both fundamentally dissatisfied with this state of affairs. So my idea is that if some kind of politics could come along that was actually comfortable with and embraced the changes that have swept through American society over the past 30 or 40 years, then that politics would then be swimming with the tide. It wouldn't be reactionary, and it should be able to command the center of American politics. Whether it happens from a Democrat who is playing to more egalitarian concerns, or whether it comes from a Republican who's playing to more socially conservative concerns, I don't know. But it seems to me that until something like that happens, we're stuck in this kind of nasty politics where we have a lot of empty symbolism. We've got gay marriage and Terry Schiavo on the right, and we've got Walmart bashing and obsessing about how the top 1% are doing over on the left, but nobody really capable of advocating policies that accomplish anything, because what they really want is to go back in time.
Yeah, I have two responses to this. The first is, as a libertarian, I would like to think that you're correct. I would like to think that, you know, an intellectual movement that embraced the you know, dynamic changes that have taken place both socially and economically over the last couple of decades would, as you point out, swim with the tide and potentially attract voters. The problem is that as a political scientist, my instinct says that there are two kinds of middles you can pursue. The first one is the kind of libertarian one that you're talking about that embraces economic liberalism and social liberalism. The problem is that I actually see politics moving in the exact opposite direction. You can argue that a politician that embraces both social conservatism and economic populism is equally in the middle,
yes,
because it's you know, attracting elements from both sides, as it were. And it seems, you know, just as an empirical matter, that those kind of views resonate much more with Americans at this point than the kind of libertarian views you're talking about. Even if you can demonstrate empirically that society is better off for the whole variety of sort of dynamic changes that have taken place because of the way the free market works, because of sort of cultural liberalization, it is much easier to sell the past than it is the future. It's much easier to sell, you know, to hammer away at issues about insecurity rather than things like, you know, expanding opportunity. So the problem I've got is that even though I'm intellectually sympathetic to your argument, politically, I mean, take a look, you know, we need to talk about this also, you know, that you're seeing this raging debate about the growth of inequality and whether or not it's a good or bad thing, which is a topic that libertarians don't generally like to talk about.
Yeah, I agree with you that certainly populist candidates or economic populist candidates did well in the 06 election. We can talk about that. And there will always be an appetite for and an audience for reactionary politics. There's always going to be people who are upset about change and who feel dislocated or threatened by change, and those people will always respond to politicians that are railing against the direction of change. So that's always going to be with us. I think it doesn't work very well on the national level. You will always have regions of the country that are being hard hit and therefore will be receptive to an economic populist message. And you'll have regions of the country that are culturally conservative and therefore, you know, they respond to social conservative messages or what we might call reactionary messages. But I would say the big problem with a politics that looks for the center with populism is that it will inevitably lead to frustration. Although people's sentiments may be there, that's not where society is. That's not where the direction of social change is, and therefore you can't deliver on your promises. You can rail against Walmart. You can rail against outsourcing. And then when you get in office, what are you going to do about it? Nothing. We had John Kerry in 2004 during the whole outsourcing kerfuffle, playing to that kind of reactionary sentiment, railing against Benedict Arnold CEOs. But then, okay, well, what are you going to do about outsourcing? And he prescribed, you know, a couple of fiddles with the tax code. So it was like he was screaming bubonic plague and prescribing a couple of Advils. Likewise, you have conservatives now for 20 years have been screaming about the decadence and slouching towards Gomorrah and cultural decline. And when they get in office, what can they do about it? Not much of anything, because they're trying to sweep back the tide. So
right.
I think in the short term, you can win with a populist message. You can win with a reactionary message. But you can reach a period where people are frustrated with that kind of politics because it's clear it doesn't really pan out in terms of action on the ground. I have some hope that we're nearing that level of frustration right now, that people are sick of Team Red demonizing Team Blue and vice versa, and that perhaps we might be receptive to someone who plays to our hopes and opportunities rather than to our fears.
But isn't that? I mean, wouldn't you argue that's the Barack? Yeah, I mean that's the Barack Obama strategy to some extent. You know, I mean this is one of the things that Obama has sort of emphasized since he announced, which is I don't want to get into this sort of. I mean, he doesn't talk about it in terms of ideas; he talks about it in terms of partisanship. But surely, I think Obama thinks one of his selling points is that precisely because he wasn't associated with either the partisanship of the '90s or you know the Iraq debate of 2002, which is, by the way, another example of how. Even foreign policy is now sort of almost foreign policy debates are retrospective,
yes.
As much as they are about the future. You know, but the problem is, I'm not sure Obama is really someone a libertarian can be terribly friendly with.
No, there's a style versus substance issue here. I think for 15 years we've seen a hunger for getting past left versus right, and we've seen
right.
people from Ross Perot to. At the state level, Jesse Ventura and Arnold Schwarzenegger to McCain in 2000, people who seemed to transcend the partisan left-right divide, mm-hmm. but they didn't really have a substantive message that made coherent sense out of that position, and so they've all been flashes in the pan. What you need is some kind of actual body of worked out ideas and a program that will marry substance to that nonpartisan trans-ideological style. I put my bid down for what such substance would look like. I hope other people will be thinking along similar lines, and we'll see where we go. But I agree right now, amongst Democrats, the populists are in the saddle, and concern with inequality and insecurity seems to trump interest in how to maximize growth and opportunity.
Just to close on this point, I mean, it's interesting that the collection of people you talked about, Ventura, Perot, Schwarzenegger, and, you know, I think Obama would potentially count in that,
right.
which is what drove all those things, you're right, there was no coherent set of ideas. It was more the idea that they were both, A, charismatic, and, B, everyone was so disgusted with the status quo in whatever situation it was that a charismatic alternative seemed as an attraction, which... I'd say from a Weberian sense might disturb me because generally the charismatics were often thought to be the lower form of government. But then again, there's a difference between politics and bureaucracy. So
right.
Maybe I've read too much of my Weber to comment on that.
No, I think when the ideological categories are broken and those are things that people have confidence in, and then what do you appeal to? You just appeal to personality. That can be something that brings people together if ideology isn't working anymore. And so I think we have seen that. And so to me, these are all symptoms of a problem with the way our politics is working right now, and whether or not some political or policy entrepreneurs can come up, can fill this vacuum, remains to be seen.
Well, speaking of the sort of public anxiety, I mean, the sort of issue du jour for the last, I'd say, 6 months or so among economists in the blogosphere and also, you know, you guys at Cato were sponsoring something on this, is the growth of economic inequality or the perceived growth of economic inequality and whether or not it's an issue and whether or not it's as widespread as some people, you know, believe it to be. I think you've got an open forum right now that Alan Reynolds is defending his argument that inequality concerns have been overstated.
Right. We have a web magazine at Cato, Cato Unbound, which this month's issue is on the inequality wars, and we have Alan Reynolds, who caused a stir with a Wall Street Journal op-ed back in December saying that he didn't see much in the way of evidence of any kind of significant sustained increase in income inequality since the late 1980s. He was pounced upon and torn to shreds by all the right-thinking sorts of the blogosphere, and so we've arranged a forum where we've got hostiles and friendlies duking it out with him this month to get to the bottom of it. And I don't know if they'll get to the bottom of it or not, because it is the inequality statistical food fight is an amazingly dense, nasty affair, and a very difficult one to get to the bottom of, because there are so many different dimensions of inequality and so many different ways to measure it that just making a blanket statement, inequality is up. Do you mean income inequality? Do you mean consumption inequality? Do you mean wealth inequality? Do you mean 90-10 inequality or 90-50 inequality? Or do you mean Gini inefficient inequality? What base years are you looking at? Are you controlling for changes in household size? Are you controlling for changes in demography with the big immigration wave? Once you sort through all of that, the way you sort through it often depends on your priors, I'm afraid. And so people who have an ideological commitment to thinking ill of our more competitive, more entrepreneurial, more globalized economy are going to be tempted to read inequality in a way where things are looking worse and worse. And so this economy is failing us because it is failing to measure up to some sense of social justice. And people who are ideologically committed to being in favor of this new, more freer, new freer and more competitive economy are likely to look at the numbers and say, I don't see a problem. So getting past people's priors and actually digging out an objective, empirical truth on this is hard work.
Well, as you said, part of the problem is that you can have multiple objective truths.
Yes.
And that's what you see in, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, let me say a few stylized facts, and then you can correct me, because this is not, exactly my area of expertise, but, I'm sort of a consumer of it. The perception I have is that, inequality is increased if you measure it by income. If you measure it by consumption, it's not nearly as stark.
That's right.
And in terms of wealth, it's also not completely clear to me, because it sort of depends on when people had their assets, or when people own their assets. I'm not completely sure about the wealth inequality.
I don't think there's been a big dramatic change in wealth inequality in recent years or the last couple of decades.
Right. Although, correct me if I'm wrong, Peter Galbraith, for example, I think has argued that, in fact, a lot of the rise in income inequality, even over the decade of the 90s, was due to, entrepreneurial activity in something like 5 zip codes or something like that, where, it was just they did well in, places like Silicon Valley and so on and so forth, and that's actually driving a lot of this.
So there's big fortunes at the top that can skew things, and there's also huge sort of compositional effects, that is, apples to oranges comparisons that you have to control for if you're going to try to figure out whether, in fact, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, or at least relatively, if not absolutely. In particular, we tend to measure income inequality in terms of household income, but households today are much smaller than they were in the 70s because of divorce and just more people living alone. So that's a big deal. Likewise, we've dumped millions of low-skill immigrants into the labor force since the early 1970s, and that exaggerates the income inequality picture. They're better off than they were in Mexico or Central America. We're better off, I would argue, to have access to this labor. Some low-wage native-born Americans may be worse off. But overall, I think it's win-win, and yet it shows up as a clear loss in terms of worsened inequality. Once you sort through all of those things, to me, the thing that stands out clearest is something that really did happen. Is that the returns to high skills relative to the returns to low skills have increased. It seems to have happened, most of that seems to have happened in the 1980s, but basically the college premium went up a lot, and the grad school premium went up even more. And so that means that the benefits of having high human capital, of having well-developed marketable skills, have gone up. And by the same token, the opportunity costs of an absence of human capital have gone up. And I think that is a matter of legitimate social concern. How do we? My take on this would not be, how do we punish the winners? Nor would it be to blur this or to interfere with the signals that are telling us that human capital is at a premium these days. And because if we reduce the returns to high human capital, then what kind of signal is that we're sending? We're telling people that they shouldn't develop the human capital right now. Given the big college premium, given the big skills premium, that's a huge incentive for people to go to college and develop high skills, and that's a good incentive structure. So the question is, how can we adjust social policy to lift people up, people who have low skills? How can we encourage them to develop them and take advantage of the massive opportunities that are available to the high skilled in this new economy?
All right, to play devil's advocate on this, though, Brink, I mean, one of the arguments that, you know, people like Paul Krugman are making is that while there is an education premium, that's not the you know, they a lot of Democrats wind up saying, yes, there's an education, you know, premium. There's no question about that. That's going on. But that's not the significant effect. The significant effect is when you look at the upper 1% or 0.1% or 0.01% of the population, and those are the ones who have truly been benefiting from the last couple decades. Which I think ties into their arguments. I mean, I haven't seen it explicitly, but I think a lot of these people are sort of asserting that it's a superstar economy. You know, that the idea that the way the economy functions now, there's certain people who are doing really well off because they win the lottery, and, you know, there's certain jobs for which, you know, there can be only so many television anchors. There can only be so many,
right.
You know, superstars in a particular profession. And if you manage to get that superstar status, it's great, but otherwise, you know, there's much more insecurity.
Yeah, I think some of that is going on, but and the you know, the tournament economy, the winner takes all economy, that you can certainly
tournament see economy, that's right, yes.
You can certainly, you know, summon up anecdotes in your mind, no problem. The question is, how big a deal is that, and is it really driving measured inequality? I think what we do know is that the wage inequality or skill gap doesn't seem to drive a lot of the measured income inequality numbers, at least not since the late 80s, because we've had a big continued increase in measured income inequality, but not a continued increase in the college premium. So it looks like it's what we call within group inequality or residual inequality, that is people who have the same skill set. That's continuing to go up. The between group inequality has kind of flattened out since the late 1980s. But that's where I think the numbers are shakiest. There was an American Economic Review piece by, I believe, the author's name is Lemieux, that came out over the summer, I think. I'm sure we'll link to it by the time this is posted.
Yeah.
But he sorted through what's driving these numbers, and his conclusion was that it's compositional effects largely, that our population is older today and better educated today, and older people have a wider spread of income than younger people because they've had more time to sort themselves out into different career paths. Better educated people have a more dispersed income distribution than less educated people, because less educated people are all concentrated around a kind of relatively low wages, whereas high educated people go from gazillionaires to think tank wage slaves like myself. Once you control for the changing demographics of the population, a lot of this goes away. That's one point. How much that makes the inequality trends of the 90s go away, I'm not entirely sure. Lemieux says it's the lion's share of it. On top of that, the question is, how relevant to public policy is what the 1% is, the top 1% are doing compared to what the top 10% are doing? I should think it's of no concern whatsoever. I think the top 10% of Americans are just the most extravagantly blessed cohort of human beings in history. And for the person sitting at the 90th percentile to be grousing about what Bill Gates is doing is just, you know, unseemly, bordering on obscene. I don't care how the top 1% are doing. I care how the top 10% are doing versus the 50th percentile and versus the 10th percentile, but I don't see any legitimate interest other than just envy and obsessing about the top 1%.
I think this is where things get occasionally a little shaky. I think the implicit argument that people, like Krugman in particular, makes this, although I don't know he's got any evidence to back it up, is the belief that equality, that there's a correlation between equality and growth and social stability. I mean, I think Krugman, you know, constantly harkens back to the 50s because he believes that since the distribution of gains was somewhat more egalitarian then, and we had a higher growth rate, and we had more political stability. Whereas he seems to feel that if there's more inequality, you know, if there's really stark inequality, if we start looking more like Brazil, that this will lead to political instability and, you know, riots and the whole mess of sort of social dysfunction
right.
that we've experienced, you know, in the past, which I'm not entirely sure I buy. Empirically, I don't know if that holds for the United States. And actually, I mean, there are arguments out there that say that less dynamic societies are actually more stable politically. I mean, this is the old Sam Huntington argument.
Right.
That's not to say that I'm therefore advocating rising inequality and stasis in the United States. It's just that it's that last step, the one to political stability, that I think I question the most.
Yeah, I don't think we're turning into a Brazil. We've got if the people who are doing very well, and that is, let's just take college educated as a surrogate for high skilled or high human capital people. You know,
or even college educated professors for that matter.
Yeah, the percentage of college educated Americans now is at an all time high. The percentage
right.
of homeowners is at an all time high. We don't have this tiny little elite that's doing great and everybody else groaning in misery at the bottom. We have, since the 80s boom began, we've had a big shift of people out of the middle and towards the right side of the bell curve on the income distribution. We had a lot of people moving up into higher real income, and the middle category
facing
has gotten a little bit smaller,
tax.
And the little and the poorer categories have gotten a little bit smaller as well. So we've just gotten richer as a society, and some people have gotten, you know, crazily rich, and I don't care. I'm sure that. That our a whole host of institutional and policy and just structural factors make it easier today for high performers to claim a larger share of the value they create. I think the easiest to understand analogy is in sports. You look back to when we were kids, football players made nothing, and now they make a whole bunch because of free agency and because they're able to really capture the economic value that they produce, or at least a higher fraction of it than they used to be able to, because teams have to compete for them.
No.
Back in the old days where you worked for the same company your whole life, there wasn't really a market for executive talent or high-skilled talent like there is today, not nearly as well-developed a one. Now the people at the top are competed for by everybody, and so they are able to command a higher fraction of the value that they produce. So they get rich. That doesn't come at the expense of people in the middle of the wage ladder or at the bottom of the wage ladder. The different skill sets are different labor markets, and those labor markets are going to work to match supply and demand at different levels. And so the fact that you're paying your executive a lot of money doesn't mean you're going to hire fewer mid-skill workers if their marginal value is more than their marginal cost. So I think it's there's a really sort of simplistic zero-sumism that suggests that if the 1% hog everything, there's nothing left for the rest of us, and that's just that just isn't how labor markets work.
No, and worse, it would potentially, you know, create some moral hazard problem where, you know, potentially politically the notion that if there's rising inequality, therefore there should be greater redistribution, it creates the expectation potentially among those less well-off that says, well, if you see this, then we can guarantee that the state will, you know, appropriate, more from the top 1% and we'll be better off as well.
Yeah,
as opposed to you know, pursuing their own individual strategies to try to improve their income stream.
Right. There's just one more point, because there's at least theoretically plausible reason for concern about inequality, which is that the rich will just control the political process.
Right, and that is related, to be fair, to what the Democrats are saying. This is actually one of the problems I've got with big government conservatism as well, which is it's caused me to sort of reappraise the notion of government privatization, you know, the idea that this sort of in-between step where the government outsources functions to the private sector but still pays for them. You know, when it was initially proposed, I mean, a long time ago, I thought, yeah, sure, this makes a great deal of sense. Hold on one second, Brent.
Sure.
We get to do this live, you know. Wait one second.
Okay.
Hello. Hi. I have to get off the phone because I'm right now talking to you in front of a Blogging Heads thing. I love you, too. Bye. Sorry about that. That was my wife.
I agree with you that government contractors aren't much of an improvement over government officials.
We all remember
the $800 toilet seats, and so that kind of privatization strikes me as what we need is competition in markets. That's more important than whether someone's nominally in the private sector or not.
Right,
but I think the concern about political power falls apart on because of its premises that the rich are politically homogeneous and have homogeneous interests, and they certainly don't. We see the rise of rich left wingers, and just generally high-income professional Democrats. There's lots of them, and indeed in some high-income professions, Democrats are dramatically outnumber Republicans. So, and we see these days the traditional funding gap between Republicans and Democrats, that is the fundraising ability, is more or less closed. So, to me, the idea that money is weighing down on one side of the political equation doesn't really pan out, and therefore the fact that there's a lot more money than there used to be doesn't suggest that one side is going to get some kind of unfair advantage.
Brink, I think this is potentially the topic for your next book. You know, I think you can write this sort of sequel to What's the Matter with Kansas. You just call it What's the Matter with Cambridge, Massachusetts. it would work out well for you.
Okay, I'll...
Well, it should be pointed out, though, that you know the sort of rise of economic populism and the concern about inequality is hardly unique to the United States.
Definitely not.
And that this has become a global problem, and in some ways far worse, you know, elsewhere. I was taking a look earlier in the week at kind of mangle her name, Ségolène Royal.
Yes.
The French the left candidate for presidency, and let's just say she's got an interesting economic platform. That includes, among other things, you know, eliminating what minor reforms were taken in French labor markets to make it easier to hire and fire people, basically public goodies for everyone, free contraception, I think, what was it, 10,000 euros for individuals just to spend as they please. I'm trying to remember what the other aspects of the program were.
The minimum wage of $2,000 a month.
Oh yeah,
that sounds like it's more than 50% above our minimum wage.
Right, the minimum wage I think roughly maybe $30,000. Would be a minimum wage in France, which you know I'm
and
sure
what,
buys
what,
a lot of
our minimum wage just moved up to what $7.50 or something like that. So,
I believe so. I'm not sure if it's been decided yet.
Yeah, but that's what they're trying to move it to, and so 2,000 hours times 8 would be 16,000 a year. So you can see the huge disparity between what we're trying to do and what she's proposing.
Right, and you know what bothers me
in a country
almost
with double-digit unemployment and low labor force participation and abysmal labor force participation with the young and with immigrant populations that she's just. In full.
Although she's better. To be fair, she is good on the immigration issue. She's much more. She hasn't been immigration bashing, which is actually the depressing thing. I mean, you think proposing a program like that, you can presumably talk about the right candidate as well. But Nicolas Sarkozy, You know, although potentially a little more business friendly. Also talks about balance. He actually said at one point, I think he talked about balancing between protection and protectionism. As yes. Protectionism is a good thing that we should, you know, therefore draw some, you know, trade protectionism is actually a good thing that we should draw some elements from. So, I mean, if that's your range of choices, I'm not sure how. I'm worried about France.
No. France is deeply in denial, and its Thatcherite moment is nowhere on the horizon. Let's put it that way.
I mean, but this is hardly limited to France. This is a global problem.
Yes.
You know, the Chinese are acting in a more populist manner, for Pete's sake.
And, of course, we've seen this throughout South America. And yeah. And so what we had in the 80s and 90s, we had the real collapse in the developing world of the state-dominated economic model, yeah. of the import substitution economic model, and a groping towards what was called the neoliberal model or the Washington Consensus
model. The Washington Consensus, right.
And for many countries went through wrenching changes and actually did get a lot of things right that they had been getting wrong before. But nonetheless, the results were disappointing. It turns out what we had hoped naively, those of us on the free market side in the 80s, was that if you follow this sort of formula of 1-2-3 of you know, macroeconomic stabilization, privatization, and opening your markets to foreign competition and investment, that you would then, with better than even odds, find yourself on this glide path towards steady, sustainable economic development and find yourself rich in a generation or so. And it hasn't worked out that way for many, many countries. It turns out that their problems were deeper and more profound and harder to fix than we thought. And so a lot of folks there have a bad taste in their mouths about free markets reforms because they went through a number of them and they haven't panned out. And so it's very easy then for demagogues and populists and reactionaries to say this whole pro-market approach was snake oil and we need to go back to the good old days of whatever crazy nostrum they come up with.
I mean, I guess there are two fears you have on this. The first is that the problem with the thing about political, you know, economic liberalization and, for that matter, economic retrenchment is that they have sort of political knock-on effects that wind up reinforcing the original policy, unless there's an exogenous shock. So,
yes.
You know, if you have a push towards protection, that you therefore create protected industries in a whole number of countries that will not exist unless the protection is not just, you know, is not just maintained, but if anything, strengthened. Because regardless of government policy, there are technological innovations that make trade easier across the board. And so as a result, you start seeing, you know, demands for even more protection, you know, once it's instilled. And so I think my concern is whether or not we're at one of those sort of tipping points. And I think, you know, it's interesting. There's an article in Foreign Affairs in the January-February issue that Rawi Abdullal and Adam Siegel wrote about this question about whether or not globalization had passed its peak.
Right.
And, you know, my fear is that they're right, that or to some extent, which is the future right now is unclear, but it might be that we've sort of reached an inflection point, and it's going to be a long decade, let's say, or, you know, where we're just going to have to ride out people making stupid policies until we get back to the recognition that, gee, maybe free markets might actually be a good thing.
Yeah, well, I wrote a book about this called Against the Dead
Against
Hand.
Against the Dead Hand, a great book, yes.
And the idea was, the premise of the book was that the kind of ideological faith in central planning and state control has died, and its death was the cause of this current episode of globalization, this turn away from the state and towards markets. For most countries, the turn didn't occur because of some sort of ideological conversion to Adam Smith. It occurred purely out of pragmatism, that their countries had blown up and they needed to do something else, and the only thing left was turning towards markets. And so it was a totally pragmatist kind of arrangement and paper thin commitment to market policies, no particular understanding or deep understanding so that you could weather the storms or implement reforms correctly. And so you have a lot of compromise and mess and form triumphing over substance and half measures and all the rest, and so you get a two steps forward, one step back, or sometimes two steps forward, three steps back dynamic.
Yeah.
Where countries reform during a crisis, and then when the crisis passes or the reforms don't work out very well, you get a reaction, and then that reactionary phase lasts a while, and then it ends badly, and so then you ultimately turn to reform again. My argument is that the reason to be hopeful over the longer term is that, unlike in the past we had a clear, defined model for anti-market forces. That was central planning. Right. And now nobody believes that anymore. And so these days, when you hit a crisis and things have fallen apart, I don't think you can turn to the socialist model as you could in the past with anywhere near the credibility that you used to be able to. So it seems to me that you're going to have countries falling off the wagon and doing bad things and reaping bitter consequences. But your argument
is that even if countries fall off the wagon, they won't fall as far, and it's easier for them to get back on the wagon if they're, you know, if the sort of de régis policies don't work out terribly well.
I think the big exception is countries that have natural resource wealth because they can just, you know, pump their tax revenues out of the ground dig them out of the ground. And so that's, you know... So in South America, Venezuela, I think, is, you know, unreformable for quite a while. And as many populist anti-market regimes as Hugo Chavez can prop up with foreign aid, those will last a while. But by and large, my hope is that we have something of a ratchet effect where it's harder to go back than it is to go forward. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't mean that we're not going to have periods of backsliding. And I think we had a huge, a revolutionary change in global political economy, starting with the debt crisis of 82, or go back a few years from that, starting with Deng Xiaoping's reforms in China in 78, going through, the Asian crisis.
Yeah.
And so that... That's a big change, and that takes some while to digest and then be ready to move on. But right now we may be in a retrenchment phase. My hope is that good news will follow.
My hope so is too, because the last thing you want is a retrenchment phase at the same time that you've got a rising power potentially threatening, the global hegemon, which is the one concern I have about if you have a retrenchment, what the Sino-American relations are going to start looking like.
Sure.
Down the road. But I guess the question I would put to you now is whether or not you think the current backsliding is going to wind up deep-sixing the Doha round.
Well,
of World Trade Talks.
Yeah, I think the Doha round is in very deep trouble, and I don't have high hopes for its successful conclusion. Even if it is concluded, my guess is that it won't be much of a success. The Doha round is a strange answer to the question, how far can you push liberalization, trade liberalization, purely on the strength of a guilty conscience? And the answer is not very. So what happened? We weren't even going to have a new round after the Uruguay round. That was the last big round that created the WTO.
Right.
It ended in 94. And it had gone on for many years. And after that, people said, never again. We can't do this. It's too bulky. It's too ungainly and cumbersome. But we had built into the Uruguay round agreements sort of built-in negotiations on agriculture and services to start in 2000, I believe. And so once those built-in negotiations were gearing up, people were thinking, well, good grief, since we're going to do these, we might as well have an omnibus round anyway so that we can have cross-sector deals and make the hard choices on agriculture with deal sweeteners in other sectors. And so the momentum geared up to try to launch a big omnibus round, and then that fell apart in Seattle. And then people felt really guilty about having the World Trade System blow up in Seattle. And then
9/11 happened.
And then the Doha ministerial meeting, which launched the Doha round, occurred 6 weeks after 9/11. So people were really feeling a guilty conscience about letting the World Trade System blow up. And so they were good boys and girls, and they got the round started. And after that, they did absolutely nothing until the Cancun ministerial conference, where it blew up again. And then people felt bad about that, and they patched things together and got the round looking like it was moving forward, but it didn't move forward at all. And when they got to Hong Kong with the next ministerial conference, there was no progress, and they couldn't make things work. And so I'm afraid we're in a situation right now where none of the major trading powers, the United States, Europe, Japan, and the larger exporting developing countries, none of them has any particular yen for trade liberalization. None of them, even on a mercantilist basis, they're more interested in their defensive protectionist interests than they are in the possible gains they could get from better market access abroad. The Europeans, the Americans, and the Japanese are all, to a greater or lesser degree, worried about cosseting their farm lobby. The developing countries all think they gave it the office during the Uruguay round, and they think they ought to get liberalization without any further commitments now. And so there just really hasn't been the kind of space for win-win deals. And so my sense is that if we can ever get this Doha round completed, and I'm not sure we will, because the fast track that you need to have to make it work here in the United States is about to expire, and I'm not sure it will be renewed anytime soon. Anyway, even if it is concluded, I think it will be a pretty penny ante deal. So we'll have had a whole lot of work and a whole lot of grunting and groaning without a lot to show for it.
Well, I mean, unfortunately, this is one of these aspects about globalization that I talk about, I talk about in my book, which is going to be coming out over the next month, called All Politics is Global, that basically argues that, ironically, it's the least globalized elements of society that wind up dictating what the great powers want to do, what their policies are going to be, about a whole range of issues. And so, again, what you're seeing right now is the power of farm lobbies in both the U.S. and the EU helping to, make it incredibly difficult to liberalize even further. Unfortunately, I think it's bad for the world. Good for my book, though.
Yes.
All right, unfortunately, I've got to get going, so I think we need to wrap this up. But I hope you enjoyed your first Blogging Heads experience.
Absolutely.
Excellent. And we'll have to make sure you do this again.
Very good. See you
again.
All right,
take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.